This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Recently, we heard from Bridge contributor Ted Roloffs on the issue of prison reform in Michigan. Among the things we discussed in that interview is that the issue has become a bipartisan cause. The U.S. Justice Action Network has brought a coalition of liberal and conservative groups together to work on changing the criminal justice system. In Michigan, that has included the state's chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union and the free market think tank, the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Holly Harris is executive director of the U.S. Justice Action Network. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a little more background on your group. How did you get started?
Well, we are relatively new. We are a 501c4 nonprofit organization, which, as you mentioned, is bipartisan, and we've got some unlikely partners in this organization. In fact, we have 8 of the most well-respected conservative and progressive entities in this country as a part of this coalition. And I'll briefly mention them just because it is so unique and unprecedented. As you mentioned, the ACLU is one of our partners, Americans for Tax Reform, FreedomWorks, the Faith and Freedom Coalition, the Center for American Progress, Right on Crime, and the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and we recently added the NAACP. So these organizations rarely agree on anything, and yet they all agree that we need criminal justice reform now. So again, it's a very unique partnership. Our goals are to safely reduce the prison population and astronomical associated costs, to get a lot of these unnecessary, duplicative, and unfair laws off the books altogether, and then to break down barriers for ex-offenders who are looking to find good jobs, support their families, and lead crime-free lives.
You've chosen to focus on a few states off the bat. One of them is Michigan. Why does Michigan stand out as a state where you think that, A, reform is needed, and B, it is doable?
Well, first of all, Michigan is in need of reform. In Michigan, both the prison population and prison admissions are on the rise. According to the Council of State Governments, at least 1 in 5 state dollars are spent on corrections. At present, Michigan has about 43,000 people incarcerated across the state, and the average annual cost to the state for housing a prisoner is approximately $35,000 a year. Again, astronomical cost to the taxpayers. On the positive side, however, Michigan has a lot of very reform-minded leaders. Your governor, Rick Snyder, recently gave a groundbreaking speech in Detroit, you know, talking about the need for a lot of these reforms. You've got great leaders in both the House and the Senate. And then additionally, your Attorney General, Bill Schuette, is now, you know, moving toward reform and certainly is being very thoughtful with how he's going to address criminal justice reform. So there's a lot of opportunity in Michigan. There's great bills moving this year that we believe will pass with bipartisan support. And then I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, of course, Michigan is very relevant in the presidential conversation, and issues that are raised in Michigan often rise to national prominence very quickly. We know Michigan will be a very hot state in 2016 in the general election. And of course, this provides our organization with a great platform to talk about these reforms.
Let's go back for a moment and talk about Attorney General Bill Schuette. When we had Ted Roloffs on recently to discuss this, he said that the Attorney General has been someone who has not been very enthusiastic about reform of the prison system. A former state representative, Joe Haveman, a Republican, who was trying to get some legislation passed at the end of the last session, expressed a lot of disappointment with the Attorney General for the fact that the legislation didn't go as far as Representative Haveman would have liked it to go when it ultimately did pass. What are the signs that you're seeing that Attorney General Bill Schuette is ready to take a different approach?
Well, one of the unique things about our organization is we are a consensus organization. The U.S. Justice Action Network not only engages the right and the left, but also law enforcement, which I think is very unique. Very often, criminal justice reform organizations have sort of been opponents to law enforcement. We view law enforcement as our partners. We've had excellent recent engagement with the Attorney General. We have found him to be very thoughtful. He's looking at the data right now and looking at ways to engage, and more to come on that. We're very hopeful and very optimistic, and certainly the Attorney General is very well respected in the legislature. As you mentioned, he can be a great force, very influential there, and we're very hopeful that he'll put his support behind some of these reforms. In fact, he recently came out in support of the civil asset forfeiture package that passed passed unanimously through the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we're very hopeful will hit the governor's desk very soon. And that really sent a phenomenal signal to law enforcement, not just in Michigan, but across the country, that it's okay to be for civil asset forfeiture reform. In fact, you know, these reforms are very needed. In fact, your listeners may not know much about civil asset forfeiture. I certainly didn't before I entered this space. It's a vehicle through which law enforcement can take your property when you haven't been charged with a crime. And this package in Michigan provides some much needed transparency to that process, raises the burden for the government to take your property, and exempts certain property from the process altogether. So we're very hopeful that this package will pass with bipartisan support, and certainly with the support of the Attorney General there.
One of the big complaints about seizing property has been that it's been a moneymaker for some local governments. The comedian John Oliver did a segment on this showing how some local governments are actually able to seize property and then turn around, they can sell it, and it kind of figures into their bottom line. Does that have to be addressed if civil asset forfeiture reform is really going to happen?
You know, it's different from state to state, but certainly there are states that are removing that direct profit incentive from law enforcement. Of course, the concern is that this is a conflict of interest, and that if law enforcement can directly profit from the seizures, that that can lead to overly zealous or inappropriate seizures. You know, the most important goal for our organization is to push the process post-conviction completely so that we ensure that innocent property owners are not entangled in this process. So we'll certainly, you know, be moving in that direction. The important thing for Michigan right now, there's inadequate reporting and there's not good data. When we know that in 2013 alone, that Michigan took in $24 million in asset forfeiture proceeds, but that's reporting under just one of four methods of forfeiture. So, and not every jurisdiction reports. So it's our goal to get accurate data and adequate data for the legislature then to look at that data and say, okay, now we know, you know, how much we are actually seizing and forfeiting. We know whether this property is in fact connected to criminal convictions or not. And so then they can move further in reform efforts.
You wrote an op-ed for The Hill in which you noted that when Bill Clinton was running for president in 1992, he promised to be tough on crime. And now says that the bill that he did ultimately sign into law, the crime bill when he was president, went too far. I'm wondering, though, has the political climate changed when it comes to crime? Because Bill Clinton at that time as a Democrat was responding, I think most people would agree, to many years of the Republicans using crime as an issue and being the party viewed as tougher on crime. And that is what Bill Clinton was responding to as a Democratic candidate for president in 1992. Has the political climate changed in such a way that prison reform can happen and crime would not be something that would be used as an issue where you would say, hey, this person went soft on criminals?
Absolutely, it's changed. And I think the most telling sign of that is both in the span of 1 week, both the House Speaker, John Boehner, and the President of the United States, who again agree on very little, both took to a podium and talked about the need to move criminal justice reform forward. You know, you mentioned that speech by then Governor Clinton, who was later elected president and signed into law what we now know to be one of the worst bills ever that in fact increased the prison population at the federal level more than 800%. President Clinton has now apologized for signing that legislation, and his wife, very recently, who's running for president, gave a speech about the need for reform. And you're seeing all the presidential candidates now, Carly Fiorina, certainly John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, Rand Paul, who's had a very robust platform on criminal justice reform. They're all of the candidates, both Republicans and Democrats, are now talking about the need for reform. And so, again, I do think the empty rhetoric of being tough on crime, I don't think people want to hear that anymore. In fact, I think what they're looking for are reforms that show that these leaders are smart on crime. We do need to safely reduce the prison population. The cost of the taxpayers, and taxpayers just are not getting, you know, a good return on their investment. When you see recidivism rates at an all-time high, you know, it's time for us to change the way we view the criminal justice system, and in fact, view offenders. You know, 1 in 3 Americans now has a criminal record. 1 in 3. We're not talking about an obscure minority anymore. When we talk about, you know, the criminal justice system, it now impacts every single American. You know, whether you are an individual with a criminal record or having a hard time finding a job, whether you're a family member or a friend of an incarcerated person, or just an everyday taxpayer shouldering the astronomical burden of incarceration, every single American is now impacted by the criminal justice system. So we are in a brave new world.
As you've noted, your organization brings together groups on the left and the right. You yourself are a conservative strategist. You were the general counsel and finance chair for the Republican Party of Kentucky. So we know which side of the aisle you're coming at this from. But can you give us maybe an idea of what you see as an evolution, if that is the right term to use, from the conservatives in these groups? I mean, are they seeing this issue differently than they were, say, 15 years ago? And how did that come about?
Yeah, I certainly think so. Where we are very lucky is that we now have data available to us by groups like CSG, the Council for State Governments, like the Pew Charitable Trust, which I personally rely on a lot for data. And we're seeing, you know, what works and what's cost effective, which is certainly very important to conservatives and Republicans. But I would also point to our conservative organizations, all of which come at these reforms from a different perspective. You know, Americans for Tax Reform certainly looks at these issues from a cost savings perspective. Freedom Works certainly looks at this, you know, from a constitutional and liberty perspective. And the Faith and Freedom Coalition talks a lot about redemption and about, you know, that these individuals, these ex-offenders, should be looked at as individuals who certainly can be saved and redeemed and come out, get good jobs, support their families, be good taxpayers, and lead productive lives. And so, you know, all of those issues, I think, are important to folks on the center-right side of the aisle. Certainly were important to me when I started working on these issues and in this space. And so, you know, what I would say is that this coalition, just look at our organization, for example, the U.S. Justice Action Network, all of these organizations come at these reforms from a different perspective, whether it's those issues I just mentioned or racial equity or civil liberties, but they all agree that these reforms are necessary, which, again, is truly unprecedented for issues like this.
Is this maybe a throwback to what we might see as old-time politics? You find people who have different interests, and you find the commonality that they can work on, the different ways that they may want to approach the issue. There could be differences there, but ultimately there's a goal, and you say you want this because of A, and you may want this because of B, and the other person may want it because of C. Is this sort of the way bipartisanship is ultimately supposed to work?
I believe so, and I hope so. I hope that we're entering a new era where the conversation is about solutions, and again, whether we come at these solutions from different perspectives may in fact be a good thing. But the most wonderful part of what I'm doing right now is that we're watching individuals who, again, rarely agree on anything, sit down, become invested in each other and in each other's success, and really talk about solutions. And I think that that's why we're going to see reform, not just at the federal level, but certainly at the state level. And we're very hopeful for reform measures in Michigan this year and beyond. In fact, I do want to mention, we talked about civil asset forfeiture reform, which I do believe will pass and hit the governor's desk this year. But there's also a piece of legislation that my organization is very interested in, and it's called presumptive parole. Currently in Michigan, individuals serve about 130%, maybe just a little bit less than 130% of their minimum sentence before they're paroled. There is a piece of legislation that's called presumptive parole, where once an individual has served 100% of his or her minimum sentence, that individual is then presumptively paroled unless the parole board can show a compelling reason that that individual should remain incarcerated. So we believe that that's a good and healthy and safe way to safely reduce the prison population, and we're hopeful that bill will pass this year.
You noted at the beginning that the NAACP has signed on, as well as many of the other groups that you've mentioned. How does the whole issue of race work in here with this different group of organizations that want to bring about some reform, you know, the racial disparities in incarceration and in sentencing, and then, of course, the tensions which we have seen over the last couple of years with the police in some areas which are predominantly minority or African-American?
Well, and Rand Paul has been a great spokesman for this issue in particular, how these extremely harsh penalties for low-level drug offenders have a disproportionate impact on communities of color. Certainly civil asset forfeiture, we know that the vast majority of seizures are cash or low-level cash seizures, and they do disproportionately impact urban communities, communities of color, and disadvantaged communities. And often those individuals who have their property seized don't know where to get help. And certainly if they did, they wouldn't have the resources to hire a lawyer, go to court, and basically sue to get their property back. So I think that's why these organizations like the NAACP, like the Center for American Progress, which is, you know, certainly an organization that addresses the communities or impacts the communities that I just mentioned, and then also the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, are leaders, great spokespersons for these communities, and the fact that they're involved in this organization and pushing these reforms is very telling.
Is there a larger conversation to also be had about how we deal with drugs in this country? What should be legal, illegal, and then what should be done about, say, treatment versus incarceration?
Sure. You know, what my organization talks about a lot is that we certainly agree that there are certain individuals who belong in prison. Your murderers, your rapists, your violent offenders, these people belong in prison. And our goal is to free up resources so that we can focus on the worst actors of our society. And the question becomes then, do these low-level drug offenders, when we send them into prison, they're going to come out someday. And the question is, when we put them in a prison population with these other individuals, the worst of our society, when they return to society, which they're going to, you know, the vast majority of these people that we put in prison are coming out someday, what are we returning to society? And so the question is, do these individuals belong in prison in the first place? And you mentioned treatment. Our organization is very supportive of treatment programs, counseling programs, you know, and again, very rigorous programs in lieu of incarceration, certainly for first offenders, because again, the real goal here is to make the community safer. And the question is, are we making the community safer when we put these people in prison? They then get out, they have a criminal record, they've spent time incarcerated, and then they have a very difficult time finding a job. In fact, I'll give you a story real quickly. There is an individual, a woman who contacted me in Pennsylvania. We're working on some reentry issues there, including expungement. And in Pennsylvania, currently, in order to have your record expunged, you have to reach the age of 70 and been crime-free for 10 years, or you have to have been dead for three. So very difficult to get your criminal record expunged in Pennsylvania. And this young woman contacted me. She had spent some time in prison. She had been involved with drugs. She'd gotten clean, gone to college, had a 4.0 GPA, had recommendations from a judge, from her professors, and she can't find a job. And so what happens with those individuals who've been serious about rehabilitation, who can't find jobs, is that they return to crime because they have no choice. And then they return to our prison population. They again become the taxpayer's problem. And again, that's what our organization is trying to address, is this cycle that has been a failure in this country.
So give us the outlook. Is there hope for your organization and all of the groups that are affiliated with it that policymakers are going to see it as a bipartisan issue, see that there is broad support, and actually take the steps to make at least some of the reforms that you would like to see?
Oh, I think there's no question. It's a perfect storm, both in Michigan and across the country and at the federal level for criminal justice reform. As I mentioned, when Speaker John Boehner and the President of the United States both in one week take to a podium and talk about the need for criminal justice reform, when you have bold leaders like the governor, like the judiciary chairs in both the House and the Senate, Clint Kesto and Rick Jones there in Michigan, you've got some really great reform-minded leaders who are pushing legislation forward. We believe it's going to pass this year. We believe civil asset forfeiture reform is going to pass. We believe presumptive parole is going to pass. We're very hopeful that we'll be able to engage the Sentencing Commission this year because recently, of course, the Supreme Court in Michigan struck down the mandatory sentencing guidelines. So we'll be very engaged in that process, which will be tedious and laborious. But again, at the end of the day, because we have such bipartisan support for these reform efforts, I believe they're going to be successful.
Holly Harris, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Holly Harris is Executive Director of the U.S. Justice Action Network. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.